Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the October issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. A new style profile. I like to refer to this issue's fashion feature as our Western Style Spectacular. The 2022 fall preview is bold, expansive, and teeming with natural beauty. Cowboys and Indians' resourceful fashion team joined forces with the creative minds from the magazine's parent company, Teton Ridge, for a multi-day photo shoot capturing a wide array of exciting trends and timeless traditions. It all went down with veteran photographer Chris Douglas behind the lens at the TR9 Ranch in Weatherford, Texas. With Western style enjoying its greatest worldwide renaissance in a long time, ever heard of the Yeehaw Agenda? It was important not to focus only on a single overarching theme. We couldn't ignore the idea of modern ranch luxe, apparel and accessories that elevate Western style for nights out and big events. And then there's the more practical and classical side to any enthusiast's wardrobe. We're talking denim, performance wear, and boots that get the job done. We had to bring in the bright colors and patterns made popular by Beacon Blankets, whose designs and textures are popping up in elegant outfits and unique outwear. And what would any Western fashion feature be without a healthy dose of fringe? Once we had the looks down, we recruited a cadre of cool and impressive folks to wear them. The faces you'll see in these pages are model beautiful, but they're also the faces of Western excellence and authenticity. We welcomed a real-life cowboy, a Canadian First Nations designer and activist, accomplished stylists and influencers, a Western artist, a Native American actor, and several of TR9's agreeable horses to help create unforgettable visuals. Much like the fashion we spotlight, this issue's cover star constantly walks the line between time-tested and progressive. Miranda Lambert has racked up countless awards, reached the highest peaks in the music industry, and dealt with the pressures and stresses that befall any household name. Thanks to a fresh set of tunes and inspired forays into fashion and home goods, Lambert is feeling more settled and confident than ever before. That confidence will serve the singer well when she launches her first Las Vegas residency later this year. We'll wager she'll be rocking plenty of fringe when she hits that stage. I'd be remiss if I didn't point you to one more fashion-focused story in this issue. We showcase and honor the award-winning work of iconic jewelry designer and former U.S. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell. Just ahead of his 90th birthday, the celebrated Northern Cheyenne artist grants us a rare retrospective interview about his storied life and career. What are your Western style essentials, and what do they mean to you beyond aesthetic appeal? We'd like to hear your personal fashion stories via letters at cowboysandindians.com. Style is a self-expression and is meant to be shared. Thunderheart and Incident at Oglala. 30 years ago, two films were inspired by a violent clash that continues to have repercussions today. By David Hofstede. In 1975, two FBI agents were killed during a shootout at South Dakota's Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. Four men were arrested, but only one, Leonard Peltier, was tried and convicted. He was sentenced to two consecutive life terms in prison. Robert Redford, long an outspoken advocate for Native American rights and issues, was among those who believed Peltier did not receive a fair trial. After visiting Peltier in prison, Redford described the case as a misapplication of justice. So that led to a long, long time of trying to help him, Redford recalled in a 2010 interview. And then, finally, and I had lobbied in D.C., I decided a film might be a better way to go. And if a documentary could be made about the injustice of his case, maybe that would help. The film, released in 1992, was Incident at Oglala. Redford served as executive producer and narrator, and he recruited British-born Michael Apted to direct. I thought, what an incredible story on so many levels, Apted said, following a 2017 screening of the film at the Hammer Museum in UCLA, though he described the production as dangerous because scars left by a century of conflicts were still deeply felt on the reservation. More than 100 years earlier, the last major armed conflict between the United States and the Plains Indians also unfolded at Pine Ridge, where more than 140 Indians, some sources put the death toll at more than 300, and more than 30 members of the 7th Cavalry were killed at the Battle of Wounded Knee. In 1973, 200 members of the American Indian Movement declared Wounded Knee the independent Oglala Sioux Nation and vowed to stay until the U.S. government met AIM demands for a change in tribal leaders, a review of all Indian treaties, and a U.S. Senate investigation of treatment of Native Americans in general. The government responded by surrounding the siege with federal marshals, resulting in exchanges of gunfire and the deaths of two Native Americans. Incident at Oglala recounts this violent history, as well as the contentious conflicts at Pine Ridge between AIM supporters and the authorized tribal government, dubbed the Guardians of the Oglala Nation. The film documents how the FBI supported the goons with weapons while observing that in the 5 years before the FBI shootout, more than 55 people had been murdered on the reservation, cases all classified as unsolved. Redford and his team make no claim for Peltier's guilt or innocence. The issue is whether Peltier received a fair trial, and the evidence they've amassed is impressively damning, wrote one reviewer. The film earned just $536,000 and never played in more than 12 theaters across the United States. Screenwriter John Fusco witnessed the skirmishes between the goons and AIM firsthand. For 5 years, he lived at the Pine Ridge Reservation, researching a script that would become Thunderheart. It was an accident that I got asked to do Thunderheart, Oglala director Michael Apted said in a 1992 interview. When I got the script and I was in the middle of preparing the documentary, I thought, holy Toledo, I can't believe it. Here's a fictional piece about the documentary I'm doing. Val Kilmer starred as buttoned-down FBI agent Ray Lavoie, who is dispatched to South Dakota to investigate the murder of Lakota tribal council member Leo Fast Elk. Lavoie's boss, played by the one-time U.S. Senator Fred Thompson, hopes that Lavoie's part Sioux heritage will make it easier for him to earn the trust of the community. Lavoie is joined in his investigation by veteran agent Frank Coutel, Sam Shepard. He also receives unsolicited advice from tribal police officer Walter Crow Horse, Graham Green, a man with one foot in the culture of his ancestors and one in the modern world. As suspects are found and lost, Lavoie discovers a deeper understanding of his heritage. In one of the key scenes, Lavoie tells Crowhorse about the dream. Lavoie, just before they caught Jimmy, I had a dream. I was running with other Indians at the Wounded Knee Cemetery. I was shot in the back. Walter Crowhorse, you were running with the old ones at the knee? Ray, I was just a dream. Crowhorse, who the hell are you, man? Ray, what do you mean? Crowhorse, you had yourself a vision. A man waits a long time to have a vision, and he may go his whole life without having one. Then along comes some instant Indian with an effing Rolex and a brand new pair of shoes, a goddamn FBI to top it all off, has himself a vision. After the disturbing vision, Crowhorse tells Lavoie that he is a Thunderheart, a Native American hero slain at Wounded Knee, who is now reincarnated to deliver them from their current troubles. The heart of the movie is Val Kilmer's development from this rather cold, ruthless FBI agent to a man you feel at the end is at peace with himself and knows who he is, which is a journey all of us take at some point in our lives, Apatow said. Thunderheart came out on the heels of 1991's Academy Award winner Dances with Wolves, which Kilmer felt enabled Thunderheart. The release came in between The Doors, in which Kilmer played Jim Morrison, and Tombstone, in which he played Doc Holliday. The other two movies might have brought more acclaim, but Thunderheart arguably hit closer to home. My father's grandmother was Cherokee, Kilmer said at a press conference around the release of the film. He was raised on reservation land in New Mexico for most of his youth, so I grew up with stories that were real life, romantic stories of the Wild West. A lot of the stories that my father told me that happened to him when he was a kid are quite vivid and got me interested in Indians. The first contemporary movie permitted to film on the Pine Ridge Reservation, Thunderheart shot for 10 weeks in the Badlands, the site of 1890's Wounded Knee Massacre, in brutal 100-degree weather. The killer flies and killer dust storms and killer rain, killer everything, Kilmer recalled, made strong impressions, but the most indelible was the people. The remarkable thing about the Sioux, or most Native Americans, is their incredible power, Kilmer said. Even before I started filming, I found it impossible to believe in how everyone could keep their sense of humor in such blight. To add authenticity to the film, the director cast several locals. One was John Trudell, as Jimmy Looks Twice, the first man suspected of murdering Leo Fast Elk. From 1973 to 1979, when the tensions depicted in Incident at Oglala took place, Trudell was the chairman and chief spokesperson for the American Indian Movement, as well as a major figure in the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee. He was an inspiration to me in making Incident at Oglala about Leonard Peltier's fight for justice, so much so that I cast him as the charismatic Indian leader in Thunderheart, Apatow said. There wasn't an untruthful moment in his performance. It was Trudell who delivered the most memorable speech in the film, when Lavoie encourages him to run. Sometimes they have to kill us, he responds, because they can't break our spirit. Thunderheart received mostly positive reviews and was a modest box office hit. Thunderheart was better informed from the fact that I did the documentary. The souls of both the films were the same, Apatow said. While both films brought new attention to the case of Leonard Peltier, he remains in prison 45 years after his conviction. Now almost 78 and in poor health, he continues to be on the minds of many who are advocating for his release and clemency. Ben Nighthorse Campbell. As he approaches his 90th birthday, we talk to famed jewelry designer and former U.S. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell about overcoming a rough childhood to lead an accomplished life by Lindsay Welchel. The best life stories aren't always about triumph. They're about trials and tribulations, too. The most memorable ones come down to what it means to make something beautiful out of something raw. Ben Nighthorse Campbell has one of those remarkable life stories. A renowned Southwestern jewelry artist and former U.S. Senator, Campbell has traveled many different paths in his long life, but the constants have always been art and family. Born in 1933 in the small town of Auburn, outside of Sacramento, California, he wasn't dealt the best hand to start. "I was born to a very dysfunctional home," Campbell says. "My mother had tuberculosis, and she was in and out of the hospital for 26 years with TB. My dad was an alcoholic and was here and gone, off all the time." He spent part of his early childhood in a Catholic orphanage and part in a ward for children of the ill in the hospital where his mother was being cared for. Despite these circumstances, young Campbell found an outlet in art. Drawing helped him escape, but around the age of 12, he soon joined his father, who was a talented jewelry maker when he was sober. The father and son duo would flatten coins on the train tracks near their house and use the silver. They weren't aiming to make money or win prizes back then. They were aiming to survive by trading the pieces they made for food and supplies. Campbell would go on to become an acclaimed artist, but that's only half of his celebrated resume. After leaving high school early to join the United States Air Force during the Korean War, Campbell got his GED after his service. He went to San Jose State University for his bachelor's degree, and it was during those years that he would really embrace his Native American heritage and his father's roots in the Northern Cheyenne tribe. In a tribal naming ceremony, Campbell was christened Nighthorse after his great-grandfather Black Horse. Eventually, he became a member of the tribe's council of 44 chiefs. Campbell's grit and determination found a physical outlet in the sport of judo. The sport would take him to Tokyo to study for several years, and Campbell would go on to win multiple titles, a gold medal in the 1963 Pan American Games, and a place on the 1964 Olympic team, though after suffering an injury, he didn't take home any medals. Beyond competition, judo would impact all areas of Campbell's life and the man he was becoming. "The long-range goal of judo is self-training through physical effort," he says today at almost 90 years of age. "I think what you'll learn is dedication and hard work, determination and focus. Those qualities you can apply to anything in life, literally, to try to succeed." After the Olympics, teaching judo led to Campbell meeting his wife Linda, a schoolteacher. They have been happily married since 1966, and Campbell is quick to credit Linda with keeping him on a forward path and bringing her organizational skills to their marriage. Campbell applied the lessons of judo to his award-winning jewelry career and also to an accomplished political career. By the 1980s, he and his family, which now included children Shannon and Colin, had moved to Colorado, where Campbell was approached to run for the state legislature. After winning that election against a beloved incumbent, he spent 4 years in office. He then won a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, the only North American Native member at that time. After 3 terms in the House, Campbell won a seat in the United States Senate. At the time, he was the only 3rd Native American elected to the Senate. Throughout his political career, Campbell focused a lot on Native American-centered bills, public land use, and water rights, as well as law enforcement and education. He had a hand in writing and passing the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988, which has given increased opportunities to Native American tribes and has been a driver of job creation, education funding, and more. Campbell's work in water rights even earned him a namesake lake, Lake Nighthorse, in Durango, Colorado. But all the good he did and all the hard work throughout his political career required considerable sacrifice. What I learned the hard way, and that's because of public office, he says. The more you give yourself to the public, the less you have to give to your family. I didn't get to see my kids grow up, and I'll never get that opportunity again. But they've become better parents than I was. Campbell is proud of the legislation he passed and the fact that a lot of Native American people were helped by those bills. But when you get all done, he says, it does cut into your creativity. Though his time in politics may have made it hard to tap into creativity, in typical Campbell fashion, he persisted when it came to his jewelry making. He set up a shop in his D.C. apartment for Ben Nighthorse Jewelry and would keep pieces he was working on in his pocket. The nice thing about jewelry is you can carry it around with you when it's half done, unlike a painting. While he wasn't allowed to sell his work while in office, Campbell could donate his pieces. He gave the jewelry to his daughter, who had grown up to become an art gallery owner. The Smithsonian gave his work as thank yous to donors in the building of the National Museum of the American Indian. The state of Colorado used Campbell's pieces to incentivize filmmakers to come work in the state. And Hollywood took notice of his creations. Today, more than 25 celebrities, including Mick Jagger and Robert Redford, have one-of-a-kind Nighthorse pieces, as do several United States presidents. Campbell retired from political office in 2005 and has worked on his art in earnest ever since. You're kind of a vehicle for all the experiences in your life, he says. I've had a lot of varied experiences, and I think they manifested themselves in an unusual kind of jewelry. In his travels around the world, both with judo and politics, Campbell has always made it a point to visit as many museums as possible. He's gained inspiration from the work of craftsmen and women everywhere, both contemporary and historical, be they the makers of the crowns of kings and queens or of ornate Japanese swords. Campbell has also absorbed things right at home in the American West, especially in his time on tribal lands and in tribal events and ceremonies. He defines his work as Southwest contemporary with Native American and cowboy-style designs. It's my jewelry, and whatever comes out of me is what they get, but I get a lot of inspiration from living in the Southwest part of the country. It's a very rich, rewarding area. There's a lot of Native people here, but also we live near places where there's art on the rocks and has been for thousands of years. I draw some inspiration from those ancient people, too, that left their mark on the stone faces of the canyons here, and that's timeless. It's not just popular today and gone tomorrow. It's been there forever, and it's going to be there forever. Campbell's list of awards for his jewelry has topped 200, but he doesn't travel the circuit chasing the ribbons anymore. Instead, he gets to his shop most days about 5 a.m. He feels most creative in the early morning, he says, and sets to work on his latest pieces, melting and casting silver, cutting turquoise and coral. If he's stuck on a piece, he'll turn it to one of his many other hobbies or outlets. Creativity for me, and I think for most people who have an artistic bent, is an ebb and flow. Some days you're really on, and you get so many ideas that float into your mind, and you can't even execute them all. Other times, you have a drought. For me, having a varied lifestyle with the ranch and horses, and I have some old cars I show in car shows, that varied kind of lifestyle is what inspires me to get back to my workbench. And then he adds, with a laugh, there are the honeydews Linda has for him that keep him busy. Wrapping up the interview, Campbell has a couple of final stories. One is about when his daughter was young and trying her hand at jewelry making. After spending time in the shop, her hands and fingernails had gotten very dirty, and the work had been hard. Jewelry is beautiful when it's done, he says, but when it's in the process of being made, sometimes it doesn't look that good. The same, as Campbell well knows, could be said for life. Judo, politics, jewelry, family. Campbell has soaked up the lessons life has offered. One of the biggest lessons I've learned is don't give up. If you can learn that skill, you can transfer that skill to anything, to business, education, to anything. Don't give up. I think I was driven not by the will to succeed, but the wish to not give up. He certainly hasn't. I'm in my late 80s, but the fact is I've still got 20/20 vision and dexterity in my hands. As long as I have that, I'm going to keep on working. I can't imagine a time when I'm not making jewelry. For more on Ben Nighthorse Jewelry, visit SorrellSky.com.
Hello, I'm Michael, and I'll be reading archive articles from True West Magazine, September 1999 edition. Butch and Sundance Slept Here, by Daniel Buck and Ann Meadows. On February 20th, 1901, Mr. and Mrs. Harry A. Place and Mr. James Ryan checked out of a New York boarding house and embarked on the British ship Herminius, bound for Argentina. As far as the other passengers were concerned, Ryan and Place were well-to-do Wyoming cattlemen. In reality, Ryan was Robert Leroy Parker, alias Butch Cassidy, and Place was Harry A. Longabaugh, otherwise known as the Sundance Kid. Mrs. Place's true identity is unknown, but she called herself Ethel, and that she was Ryan's sister. The relationships thus accounted for, the trio could travel and live together without offending Victorian sensibilities. Upon arriving in Buenos Aires, a month later, they checked into the Hotel Europa on Calle 25 de Mayo at the corner of Calle Gengayo, today Calle Peron. The rear of the hotel faced the Rio de la Plata, and the words Hotel Europa, painted in large letters on both the first and second stories, beckoned passengers as their ships docked nearby. The hotel was owned by Antonio Claraz. His brother Jorge, a natural scientist, had lived there when he wasn't exploring the Argentine frontier. Although the Claraz brothers were of French extraction, they were raised in Switzerland and were therefore considered Swiss by their Argentine friends. Jorge returned home in 1882, but Antonio was still presiding at the hotel when Butch, Sundance, and Ethel appeared at his registration desk. Some years before, the Europa had been the preferred hostelry of Scottish writer-adventurer Robert Bonteen Cunningham Graham. In a sketch, Le Chef, he reminisced about the good old days at the hotel. The life of Buenos Aires ran before its door, only three squares away from the two great plazas, with their palaces and barracks basked in the sun or shivered in the wind, according as the pampero whistled or the hot north wind blew. The stock exchange was near, the mole within a stone's throw, and up the Calle de Cangallo, which looked more like a dry canal than a great thoroughfare, stood several of the principal hotels. The Europa was built all round a courtyard with a great archway over which rooms upon an upper floor where Jorge Clarez kept his saddlery, his books, and natural history collections. The rest of the establishment was but one story high, though being built on a bank, it looked right out of the River Plate. The hotel's guests were all either commercial travelers or sheep or cattle farmers who strode into the place with a Basque porter, carrying their saddles, took off their pistols, hung them on their beds, and called for drink intermittently, stamping about the brick courtyard in their long riding boots and spurs. As the rooms looked out into the yard, the fashion was to leave the doors wide open and to converse whilst lying on your bed with anyone you knew. In some respects, the place was like a school, with the initial difference that you were pretty much sure to learn some things worth knowing in a day or two. If the Europa had a dormitory atmosphere, by night it took on the trappings of a wild and woolly men's club. We either talked or played billiards, drinking the Wild Mate or Caña Punch, or a decoction we called La Boción Cavantos, compounded of such simples as white curacao, gum, gin, and bitters, and a little lemon juice. Cunningham Graham's biographer, A.J. Tiffsley, described the Europa's clientele and their rowdy behavior. Clarez's was the favorite meeting place for ranchers, or camp men, as they were called in the Argentine. For whenever such pioneers came into town, they were sure to meet old friends in this hostelry, a bachelor's establishment where, to put it in popular terms, the sky was the limit. It was advisable not to sit reading late at night at Clarez's, for one of the practical jokes of fellows coming back after a merriment was to shoot the candles out, an annoying experience for the peaceful reader. How well Ethel adjusted to life at the Europa is a matter for speculation. If she was a schoolteacher, as screenwriter William Goldman and others believe, she might well have been uncomfortable there. If her background was more exotic, as some have suggested, she would probably have fit right in, perhaps even joining the boys and shooting billiards, or the occasional candle, and downing Caña Punch. Although Buenos Aires had elegant architecture, boulevards, and sidewalk cafes reminiscent of Paris, the city's streets teemed with something that would have made the expatriates from the Rocky Mountain West feel right at home. Cunningham Graham described the scene in the vicinity of the Europa. Horses were commoner than dogs. They stood at every house, with their feet hobbled during the time their owners talked or drank. Before the stock exchange, dozens or sometimes hundreds of horses stood, and stockbrokers felt their way cautiously amongst them with proprietary words, hissing and chirruping, and sometimes coming to a standstill, so to speak. Storm stayed amongst a sea of tails and hoofs too difficult to pass. Three blocks south of the hotel was the huge, newly created Plaza de Mayo, a merger of the Plaza Victoria and the Plaza 25 de Mayo, the two great plazas referred to by Cunningham Graham. The Plaza de Mayo was anchored on the riverside by the massive Casa Rosada, which housed the presidential and executive branch offices. Around the corner from the Europa, on Calle Reconquista, stood the venerable Banco de Londres y Río de la Plata, where Sundance opened an account with $12,000 in gold notes soon after arriving in Argentina. The American consulate was a few blocks northwest of the Europa, in the 900 block of Calle Cordoba, and the trio went there for advice on establishing a ranch. Vice Counsel George Newberry, a transplanted dentist from New York, suggested that they head for Patagonia, as southern Argentina is known. He had an estancia there himself and was planning to recruit other North Americans to colonize a large piece of government land just north of the Cholula Valley. Butch, Sundance, and Ethel vacated the congenial Hotel Europa sometime in mid-1901, traveled by train southwest to Bahia Blanca, and spent the night there while waiting to change trains. The name of their hotel in Bahia Blanca is unknown, but they undoubtedly carried Albert B. Martinez's Bodegas de la República Argentina, which offered a choice of five. The best, the Lordress charged $5 a person, including wine. The next day, they boarded another train and rode west to Neuquén. They then bought a wagon and horses for the 400-mile journey south to Cholita Valley in the northwest corner of the Chubut Territory, where they settled on 625 hectares of government land. The threesome spent nearly four tranquil years ranching at Cholita. During this period, Sundance and Ethel occasionally returned to the United States, usually after traveling east by wagon to Puerto Madryn or Rawson, small ports that had regular passenger service to Buenos Aires on several steamboat lines. In March 1902, Butch accompanied them as far as the city, where all three checked into the Europa. Sundance and Ethel soon traveled on to New York, but Butch remained in Buenos Aires for 3 weeks and filed a document with the Colonial Land Department petitioning the Argentine government for the right to purchase the land on which the trio's ranch stood. That April, while returning to Cholila, Butch passed through Trelew, the commercial center of the Welsh colony, 10 miles inland from Rawson. He registered at the Hotel de Globo, which was owned by Angela Botaro. The Globo quickly became one of his favorite stopping places, perhaps because Botaro was kind enough to cash a $3,546 check drawn on the Banco de Lourdes y Rio de la Plata account. An acquaintance named Robert O. Jones bumped into the trio at the Globo the following year, and Chubut policeman Julio O. de Antueno reported that Place and Ryan always stayed at the Globo when they were in Trulo. He added that they spent several hours every day relaxing at the nearby Banco de la Nación because they had a close friendship with its manager, a fellow North American named Lincoln Howard. In August 1902, when Sundance and Ethel returned from their first trip to the States, they stayed at the Hotel Europa for 5 days. Before embarking on the Chubut for Puerto Madryn, Sundance closed the account at the Banco de Londres y Rio de la Plata, withdrawing the balance of $1,105.50. 7 months later, Pinkerton detective Frank P. Diamo, who had been on assignment in Brazil, was sent to Argentina to follow up on reports from the agency's postal informants that the outlaws were living there. "I got my first lead at the bank," Diamo told the Wild Bunch historian James Horan. The bank's manager apparently recognized a photograph of Sundance. Unable to raise funds for pursuing the bandits all the way to Cholita, the Pinkertons had to be content with furnishing the Buenos Aires police with wanted posters of the fugitives and a warning that any daring bank or train holdups committed in the future would undoubtedly be their handiwork. Thanks to these efforts by the Pinkertons, Butch and Sundance became the prime suspects in the February 1905 holdup of a bank in Rio Gallegos, some 700 miles south of Cholila. Although they had not committed the robbery, they couldn't afford to be picked up by the police for questioning. They sold their Argentine holdings and fled to Chile in May. Perhaps in response to having been unjustly accused, they returned briefly in December to rob the Banco de la Nación in Villa Mercedes in central Argentina. While casing the job and preparing their escape route, they lodged at a nearby ranch, the Estancia de Luna. Shortly after this holdup, in which she had participated, Ethel went back to the United States. The last report of her whereabouts had her living in San Francisco in March 1906, perhaps under the name Ethel Matthews. At that time, Butch was in Antofagasta, a port on the coast of northern Chile. The trio had apparently spent some time there in 1905, but very little is known about their Chilean activities. The Pinkerton learned from a postal informant that Sundance, using the alias Frank Boyd, had run into some unnamed difficulty with the Chilean government, but had settled the matter for 1,500 pesos, or dollars, with the help of Frank Aller, the American Vice Consul in Antofagasta. In late 1906, Butch and Sundance had made their way to Bolivia, where and they were working under the aliases James Santiago Maxwell and Harry A. Brown as payroll guards for the Concordia Tin Mine, Percy Siebert, an American mining engineer who became their supervisor, told James Horan that he had first met Maxwell and Brown at a Concordia Christmas party in a hotel in La Paz. He provided Horan with a photograph of a hotel, which was mistakenly captured the Grand Hotel San Vicente in Horan and Paul Sands' pictorial History of the Wild West. The establishment was, in fact, the Grand Hotel Guibert, located on a corner of La Paz's Plaza Murillo. Butch and Sundance undoubtedly frequented the Guibert, which was a favorite of foreign tourists, explorers, and commercial travelers. English explorer and prospector Cecil Herbert Prodgers, for example, stayed at the Guibert in 1903 and described the hotel's assets and shortcomings. "The rooms are well furnished, the food is very good, and the prices of everything, even the drinks, are extremely reasonable. The only drawback was that there was no decent lavatory and not a single bath in the place. So the first thing I did on arriving was to go out and buy the largest tub that I could find for my morning dip." Prodgers undoubtedly spent all day looking for a tub his size. He was more than 6 feet tall and weighed 235 pounds. American mountain climber Annie Peck was another regular at the hotel, which was named for its French owner, A. Guibert. She first visited Bolivia in July 1903 for what proved to be an unsuccessful ascent of Mount Ilampu. She spoke fondly of the Hotel Guibert in spite of its deficiencies. "While some conveniences were lacking, even necessities as we regard them, such as a bathroom and toilet with running water, the large bedroom was comfortably furnished with Brussels carpet and heavy, handsome furniture, including a curtained bed with nice warm blankets." Another hotel that figured into the outlaw's story was the Americano in Oruro, a mining city in central Bolivia with a substantial foreign community. Nearly a quarter of the 22,000 residents were European. According to former Vice Consul Frank Aller, who wrote to the American legation in La Paz in an effort to help settle Sundance's estate in Chile after hearing that he and a companion named Maxwell had been killed in Bolivia, the last address of Frank Boyd, or H.A. Brown, was American Hotel, Oruro. The hotel, located up the street from the train station, is now a nondescript apartment building. Butch and Sundance apparently were not the only bandits to frequent the Americano. It was also the scene of an ingenious attempted bank robbery. In September 1908, a gang of a dozen or so Chileans burrowed a tunnel from the hotel's cellar toward the vault of the bank that stood directly across the street. Unfortunately for the gang, bank employees, who were working late on the night of the bandits had planned to perforate the vault, heard the sounds of the digging and called the police. After a short gunfight with the bandits, the police finished them off by tossing dynamite into the tunnel. The last hotel Butch and Sundance ever checked into was the aptly named Terminus in Tupiza, 325 miles south of Oruro, the gateway for goods and travelers entering Bolivia from Argentina. Tupiza had several thousand inhabitants, some 200 of whom were foreigners. Founded in the late 1500s in a valley of the Tupiza River, the town rose to prominence as a way station on the colonial Camino Real between Buenos Aires and Lima. By the late 1800s, with the construction of a railroad from the coast of Chile to central Bolivia, Tupiza had lost some of its luster, but it remained a mining, government, and commercial center and was home to the Aramayo family, founders and owners of Aramayo Frank y Compañía, the preeminent mining enterprise in southern Bolivia. Chadrus Huasi, the Aramayo family's imposing Italianate villa, stood just across the river from the town. The terminus was located on the Plaza Independencia and advertised itself as the best hotel in Tupiza, with the most distinguished clientele, featuring furnished rooms, special apartments for traveling salesmen, a first-class dining room and bar, excellent service, and modest prices. Yale University professor Hiram Bingham, who was in Tupiza for a couple of days in mid-November 1908, disputed some of the ad's claims in his book Across South America. Our inn, the Hotel Terminus, a low, long building, once whitewashed, with a courtyard paved with cobblestones and a few bedrooms opening into the court, was run by an amicable rascal who, I believed, claimed to be an Australian. However that may be, he belonged to the type that believes in charging foreigners double the regular fare. For one roast fowl, $2, a bottle of Vichy, $1.25, one bottle of German beer, $1, half pint Apollinaris, 40 cents. The proprietor appeared to be drunk most of the time, but he was not too drunk to charge up all the drinks to his American guests. To resolve his dispute with the landlord, Ernest Severon, Bingham sought assistance from the Santiago Hutchin, who owned a passenger freight and mail service and had transported Bingham and his assistant up from the Argentine border by carriage. Hutchin, however, not only lived in the terminus, but also ran his business out of it and depended upon the hotel proprietor for a number of favors. Bingham's request naturally put Hutchin in an embarrassing situation, and all he could say was that the charges seemed to him to be regular. El Choluk, a twice-weekly newspaper published in Tupiza from 1907 to 1912 and named for the mineral-rich 17,360-foot volcanic mountain that dominates the skyline north of Tupiza, kept its readers abreast of birthdays, illnesses, and engagements, announced family excursions to country homes, as well as business trips to La Paz, Antofagasta, and Buenos Aires, and listed the names of guests at the Tupiza's two major hotels, the Terminus and the Independente. The November 4, 1908 edition reported that a man named Santiago Lowe had recently lodged at the Terminus. James Lowe was an alias Butch had used in the late 1890s while punching cows at the W.S. Ranch near Alma, New Mexico. He had used the name James, or its Spanish equivalent, Santiago, throughout his stay in South America. He was James Santiago Ryan in Cholila and James Santiago Maxwell in Concordia. Horan and San reported that Butch and Sundance had been known as the Lowe brothers in southern Bolivia and that Butch had nearly had his cover blown shortly before his last holdup. A Reverend Winberg, a Norwegian missionary who had met Cassidy in northern Bolivia, ran across him in the lobby of a hotel in Tupiza. "Why, Mr. Maxwell," he said, "how are you?" Cassidy gave him a cold stare. "I am fine," he replied, "but my name is Lowe," and then walked away. A.G. Francis, a British mining engineer who was overseeing the moving of a gold dredge for the San Juan de Oro Company, knew Butch and Sundance as Lowe and Smith. He gave Butch's Christian name as George and Sundance's as Frank, although he generally referred to them by their surnames alone in writing up his encounter with them, 5 years after the fact, in The End of an Outlaw for Wide World Magazine, an English true adventure pulp. Francis might have misremembered Butch's first name, or it may have been supplied by his editor, inasmuch as Butch had served time in a Wyoming prison as George Cassidy, and his real name was given as George Parker on the Pinkerton's wanted posters. According to Francis, Lowe and Smith stayed with him on and off between August and November 1908. It is impossible to determine the precise days Low was lodged in the terminus because El Chorlik simply named guests who had registered since the previous edition was published, which in this case was October 31st. None of Sundance's known aliases appeared on the guest list, but the newspaper didn't print every name. Neither Bingham nor his assistant was listed during their stay at the terminus. And it is possible that Butch registered for both of them. In any event, by the time the November 4th edition was published, Mr. Lowe had already left town. Early on the morning of November 3rd, Butch and Sundance saddled their mules and rode off in pursuit of Aramaro, Frank y Compañía manager Carlos Perot, who had picked up a 15,000 Bolivian payroll from the office behind Chahuasi and set off with his son and a servant on a three-day trek to the company's headquarters in Cachisla. At 9:15 on the morning of November 4th, the well-armed bandits confronted Perot on a rugged stretch of the trail near the foot of the Huaca Huanyusca and relieved him of the payroll and a prized mule. 2 days later, the pair committed suicide after being cornered and wounded by a three-man patrol in an adobe hut in San Vicente, 14,370 feet up in the cold, wind-raked southern Bolivian Andes. Among the dead outlaws' effects, which were inventoried by local officials, were 14 calling cards, half inscribed with the name Enrique B. Hutchison and half with the name Edward Graydon. These cards led some to theorize that the bandits were, in fact, Hutchian and Gradian. But both men were well-known in Tapiza and frequent guests at the Hotel Terminus. Their names appeared often in the El Chorlok well into December 1908, when the paper dropped the hotel guest feature. Butch and Sundance had had plenty of opportunities to obtain the calling cards. Enrique Hutchian was the half-brother of Santiago Hutchian, who had known the bandits from their days at Concordia and might have introduced them to his sibling. According to El Chorlok, Santiago Hutchian's company had the contract to move the gold dredge for the San Juan del Oro Company, and Edward Graydon was the company's agent and manager. Butch and Sundance could have easily met Graydon while banking with A.G. Francis at the company's installations at Verdugo and Tumahuaco. Juan Felix Erazo, a laborer in Estarca, told judicial authorities that Graydon had introduced him to Sundance in October. Erazo saw Sundance again, this time with Butch, on the morning of November 6th. They were in Cucho, heading for San Vicente, having spent the previous night at the home of Narcisca de Burgos, who lived between Estarca and Cucho. In his Wide World magazine article, Francis wrote that Butch and Sundance had originally schemed on robbing the Banco Nacional, also on the Plaza Independencia, but that the arrival of a detachment of soldiers had forced a change in plans. The Aramayo payroll became their new quarry. News stories in El Chorlok confirm Francis's account. A large number of soldiers from Bolivia's elite cavalry unit, the Aboroa Regiment, arrived in Tupiza on November 1st. The regiment's 18 officers were quartered at the Hotel Independiente, which was near both the bank and the terminus. If Francis was correct in saying that the arrival of the soldiers triggered the bandits' decisions to go after the Aramayo payroll rather than hold up the bank, the need to move quickly precluded the kind of careful preparations Butch and Sundance usually made, which may account for the disaster that followed. No heavy clothing was found among their effects, which suggests that they had originally intended to head for the lower, warmer altitudes of Argentina. But Carlos Perot had spread the alarm much sooner than they might have expected, in view of the isolated spot they had chosen for the holdup, and by the time they awoke in Francis's place the next morning, patrols were already scourging the countryside. Perhaps fearing that the authorities at the border had been alerted, they had. Butch and Sundance made a wide U-turn and headed northwest. By taking this route, they put a mountain range between themselves and the Abarora soldiers, but they hadn't counted on running into the small patrol that had quickly marched 100 miles south from another Abarora unit in Uyuni to intercept them in San Vicente. Without cold weather gear, camping at 14,000 feet was out of the question. In any case, the barren landscape offered no forage for their mules. They had no recourse but to seek shelter and fodder in one of the few towns in the region. San Vicente was so remote that it must have seemed safe. As they settled into the chilly adobe hut and sat down to a meal of beer and tinned sardines, they may have looked back fondly on the hotel terminus, but they had little time for reflection. Two soldiers and a police inspector entered the courtyard and Butch opened fire. The ensuing battle lasted no more than 15 minutes and ended with Butch shooting the badly wounded Sundance between the eyes and then turning the gun on himself. The next day, the bandits checked into the San Vicente Cemetery.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.